You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network. Visit bpn.fm to discover more.
I'm Sammy Canold, and this is The Fabulous Invalid.
Welcome to The Fabulous Invalid, a Broadway-centric podcast where we take a 360-degree view of the theater through interviews with writers, actors, directors, designers, and everyone in between. I'm Jamie Dumont, former Broadway marketer, personal chef, and event planner.
I'm Rob Russo, writer and theater critic with StageLeft.nyc.
And I'm Jennifer Simard, formerly of Mean Girls and about to appear in Company on Broadway.
Yay!
Woohoo!
Door rings, door chimes, something.
In walks Jen Simard. Yeah. That's what my friend Erica Henningsen kept singing yesterday. She just sang everything related to Company, and she would switch all the lyrics to my name. So funny.
The social media love yesterday for you on your final performance of Mean Girls was really wonderful to watch, yeah. Jennifer.
I have a good group of kids.
Yeah, they are. Yeah. They really are.
And you were there last night. Yes. Again, your support is so incredible. Thank you so much.
We've seen Mean Girls probably more than I've seen most shows this last season.
Honestly.
Yeah. You know. I'm a big fan. You know, we've said this before. It's a great show. It's just a really well-done show.
Yeah.
And you are magnificent in it.
Oh, thank you so much.
Were magnificent in
thank
it.
Thank you. I know.
Will forever be.
I have to process it all. No, and none of it would have been possible without Tina Fey. So bravo, Tina.
Yeah. How's it feel? You've closed this door.
Yeah. I feel good. I feel relaxed. My shoulders have dropped. It's in any walk of life, no matter what you do for a living, there's a lot of pressure involved when you start a new job because you want to not disappoint your superiors. You want to, like high school, get along with everybody, be liked, have them, you know, like them. And I think other than the job itself and working with Tina Fey and Casey Nicholaw and how incredible that was, I think my biggest takeaway is that it felt so good to earn the love and respect of these kids. They could actually be my children. That's how big an age gap there is. And my best analogy is it felt like when you come into a show and you take over, like I'm a stepmom, you know, because I took over for my friend Carrie Butler, and she was so beloved, of course. And so, you know, I'm the stepmom, and like, we're not going to call you mom, we're going to call you Jen. And then by the end of this whole run, they're like, mom, we love you, you know, and it's just, there's nothing more satisfying than that, you know? Yeah. And I feel so grateful, and I feel proud that that's how it ended, that we really do love each other so much. And I think that was evident yesterday, and like they all just showed up and they came to the party and that genuinely seemed so excited. Yeah. And that's the part that feels the nicest. I love those kids. Yeah. I love them.
Well, that curtain call when they all swarmed you at the end.
Yeah, we do that. Now that's so tradition. Sweet. We do that for everyone who, you know, leaves. Starts the show, is their first debut or leaves the show. Mm-hmm. And it's really a unique group over there, and I'm going to miss them terribly.
It's a nice tradition.
Yeah.
Well, Company is very fortunate to have you.
Oh,
but I'm going to put
you
on the spot super quickly because I just have a question for you. This is something we did once long ago, and we didn't, we never picked it up.
Yeah.
But when we did our trial episode, we played this game, and we didn't end up using it on the show for a variety of reasons. But I'm going to ask this to you now.
Yeah.
Shag, marry, kill, Mrs. George, Mrs. Heron, Miss Norberry.
Oh, shag, marry, kill. I think I would shag Mrs. George because I think she'd just be so much fun in the sack, right?
Yeah, I agree.
Oh yeah,
she kinky.
Uh-huh. I think I would marry Ms. Norberry because she's, I think, the most like me, and I'd know how to talk to myself. And I think I'd kill Ms. Heron, not mostly by default because I love her, but you know she's maybe a little too crunchy granola for me.
I think the shoes. I think those shoes
just
warrant
the shoes
death.
Alone.
Yeah, right there.
You know, and my tunic.
Hey, Andy. I'm Sabrina George. Here is my audition for The Real Housewives of Illinois. I'm a mom who knows what she wants. Approval from her daughter. Remember, real beauty comes from the face. And your plastic surgeon, who has his own reality show. They say Regina's bark is worse than her bite, but trust me, it's not. That bite got infected.
Mm-hmm.
Tonight, we are excited to have with us at our table at Orso, Sammy Canold, a director who is one of Forbes magazine's 30 Under 30 in Hollywood and Entertainment of 2019. As we'll talk about extensively, she recently directed a stunning new production of Evita at New York City Center. And up next, she'll be directing Celine Song's Endlings off-Broadway at New York Theatre Workshop after having helmed the world premiere at the American Repertory Theatre. Sammy, we're delighted to have you with us tonight.
Thank you for having me. I'm so excited.
Yes, we're delighted.
We're very happy you're here on this rainy night.
Likewise, right, it is yes. So rainy.
It is, and it's going to rain all week. So why can't we get a little snow is what I want to know.
It's
much prefer the snow. So, Sammy, you are fresh off the heels of your spectacular production of Evita at City Center, which was part of their annual gala.
Yes. And
the production that you directed is a slightly revised production with a little sort of new twist. Tell us a little bit about your show.
So, I've been obsessed with Evita since I was in high school, and it is my favorite musical. It is a musical that means the most to me. And I read every book I could get my hands on about Eva Perón and about her life. And as I was reading, the more I read, the more I was struck by the line in the musical that there was nowhere she'd been at the age of 15 that says that Eva's 15 at the beginning of the show. Because every time that I saw the show, it was a woman who was in her 30s playing the role. And it's theater, but at the same time, I was so excited about what it would mean to actually put a teenager in the role at that point in the musical and see what it means for the rest of the musical if we start with a young person, for the reason of you know, authenticity, but also for the reason of the more I read, the more that I understood that when she was a teenager, there were multiple incidents of rape and sexual assault in her young life, and if her encounter with Magaldi actually happened, she would have been 15 and he would have been 36, and I think in 2019, we understand that differently than it may have been understood in the 1970s. And so having the opportunity to tell that story visually with the lyrics that are already miraculously in the show, like Tim Rice's acknowledgement of her age and it being not appropriate that this relationship happened, is it all over the text. But we had the opportunity to bring it out visually in this new time, and it was such a special opportunity, and I loved every minute of it, so grateful.
I was talking to Rob before you got here, and I told him that a very, very long time ago I got to play the mistress. And he says, well, you should tell her because she does a wonderful thing with Another Suitcase, Another Hall, and can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so when I was, as soon as we realized we were going to have two Evas in this production, we went through the show to try to figure out how it would, what the ripple effects would be elsewhere. And when we got to Another Suitcase and I was listening to it, I was like, oh, Another Suitcase is this girl's narrative. It is the mistress's narrative, but really it's Eva's narrative, because it is the narrative that 15-year-old Eva would have sung if we ever got to hear what was in her soul. So what we did was, you know, with permission from the powers that be, the mistress sang the verses of the song, but Eva and young Eva sang the choruses together, and young Eva appeared in flashback mirroring the mistress, so that we understood that the experience that the mistress was going through, having just been thrown out by the now very empowered, very in charge version of Eva, is exactly what she went through as a young person. And what does that mean for the older version of Eva to be seeing her younger self in this girl who she's just kicked out to the streets? Mm-hmm. So that I think, to me, that's sort of the centerpiece of this production. And I told my assistant and associate that it is the number that I would like to be performed at my funeral. not in a morbid sense, but it is the number that to me is like what I have to say to the world as a director is like is in that number, I think. So.
Time and time again, I've said that I don't care, that I'm immune to gloom, that I'm hard through and through. But every time it matters, all my words desert me, so anyone can hurt me, and they do.
Another suitcase and another.
So what happens now?
Take your picture off another wall.
Where am I going?
You'll get guitar you always have before.
Where am I going to?
Well, I have to say, I mean, when I had first read about the concept, you know, just like a single line in press materials that there were going to be two actors playing it. At first I was like, oh, so someone's doing the matinees, someone's doing the evening, right?
Yes.
But then I like read it again. I was like, oh, no. They're both playing the part in, you know, every night.
Yeah.
And it occurred to me that, like, you know, that glow up moment for Ava is early on in the show, right? I mean, it's Buenos Aires, right?
Yeah.
It's when she comes to the big city and suddenly, you know, she really advances. So I thought, oh, okay, so young Ava's really only going to be in it for like the first 10 minutes or something, right? But then as you just alluded to, you so beautifully weaved sort of the ghost, if you will, of young Ava throughout the entire production.
Yeah, she comes back a lot.
Was that like a process of trial and error, or did you have a clear vision from the get-go of where she would show up again?
It was completely trial and error. And yeah. We had an amazing brain trust of our creative team, which is like sit until like 1 a.m. like being like, okay, what if she has these 7 appearances? Nope, it should probably be 5. And, you know, where are they and how does she function? And I think what we landed on, actually, as a result of some amazing notes that we got from Janine Tesori, who came to one of our early run-throughs.
Good person to give notes.
So good. Yeah. So good. The best.
Right.
And she, I think, you know, as a director, I'm starting to find that I think a lot in pictures, like in what's going to be an evocative picture. And I would make these pictures where, like, young Ava would come in a way that would, like, mirror Ava. But then Janine was like, what does that mean? Like, who is she? And I was like, oh, yeah, I guess that's an important question. and so we took a step back and we said, okay, who is young Ava after she transitions into older Ava? Because we knew we wanted to bring young Ava back. We knew that was like having a conversation between young Ava and older Ava was like the meat of what having two Avas allows you to do. But we didn't know what purpose young Ava served in Ava's life. Mm. So what Janine unlocked for us is that young Ava became a flashback. Mm. Every time she appeared, it was an allusion to something that had happened in the first 15 minutes of the show that we brought back as a way of either triggering Saleha, who played the older Ava, or her reckoning with her past self, or at the end of the play, her seeing her past self in a moment where she's failed and saying, oh God, I let down the memory of my younger self, and what does that mean for my demise at the end here? So anyway, it was all trial and error, and we did this amazing pre-pro process with 27 PACE students who helped us to figure out how to stage the show. And when we did the run-throughs with PACE, we had like so many more appearances of young Ava, and then Jack Vertel, who is also somebody who you really want giving you notes,
good
extraordinary notes, said, "I think you have diminishing returns on the flashbacks." And we were like, "Yeah,
very polite way."
We do. Sweet about it, sweetest man. But aww, we had diminishing returns.
Yeah. I understand you went to Argentina to do research.
I did.
How did that inform the piece for you?
Massively. Mm-hmm. I've been 3 times. I went once when I directed the show in college, thanks to some amazing grant funding, and then went twice this summer with the show's associate director, Rebecca Aparicio, and we interviewed so many people who either knew Ava or whose lives had been affected by her, and it's extraordinary because I think for me, as someone who's not Argentinian, I first and foremost saw it as my responsibility to get to know the subject as intimately as I possibly could, because she's a woman who means so much to so many people in this country that for me to say I know her without actually knowing her would I think be irresponsible. So it was like that base level of like, am I going to get the facts right? Am I going to know her as intimately as I need to? But then on a deeper level, you know, we got to talk to this woman named Maria Eugenia Alvarez, who is now 92 years old. And in the 50s, she was Ava's private nurse when she was dying of cancer.
Okay.
And
wow.
She's extraordinary. And she, we went to her family's home and we talked to her for 2.5 hours. And she just told us stories of what it was like to talk to Ava on her deathbed. And we were so, and it all sort of trickled its way into the show, sometimes in visible ways in the sense that, like, we had an ensemble member who played Maria Eugenia in the show who was this nurse who did certain things that she did, but also just, like, in ways that I don't know that we necessarily clock. Like, we, for example, in Hunin, when Magaldi's trying to leave and Eva won't let him, typically that number is performed as if Magaldi is, like, flying solo in this town all by himself. But on our trip to Argentina, all the historians kept saying to us, well, you know, his wife was there. And we were like, oh, that's complicated. So we put a woman from our ensemble who played Magaldi's wife into the scene to see what that would do. We didn't add any text, obviously. We were like, what's it going to do if, you know, she's there complicating the picture for 15-year-old Eva, who thinks she had a one-night stand with a single man who's not so single. Mm-hmm. Tim Rice came to see the show, he was very complimentary, very nice. I saw him in intermission, and he started going through all the things that he liked, which was very generous of him. And then he goes, and then Magaldi's wife. At first I was like, what is she doing? And then I was like, okay.
It's funny because, you know, you mentioned a minute ago that, you know, you're a director who thinks very much in image. Mm-hmm. And so was Hal Prince, right? Who originally directed Evita, right? I don't think there's a mistake that you both had success putting this piece on stage. But as you're mentioning these moments, they're all popping right back into my head, you know?
Oh, and I'm so glad.
It's incredible because a show like Evita, you know, for those who don't know it, it's almost entirely sung. There's very little text,
yeah,
right? And and you're not going to change the text, obviously. And
right.
Tim Rice is one of the greatest lyricists of
all time,
right?
How exciting that he came to see
you. And then he tweeted about it.
Oh my gosh, bravo.
I know, you're very jazzed.
But the challenge that comes with that, of course, a show that is entirely sung, is that you're locked into a rhythm with the music and certain things that have to happen. How do you approach a musical that is almost entirely sung as a director? Because I imagine you also had a choreographer you were working with to, you know, do dance as well.
Yeah, we had an amazing choreography team of actually two choreographers, one who is named Valeria Solomonov, who's an Argentine tango choreographer.
Mm. And now I'm thinking of those tango dancers.
Right?
Yes, it's all coming
right
back.
I'm so glad.
Yes.
Images.
Those images are working.
And then Emily Maltby, who I've collaborated quite a bit with, and the two of them were like dynamite together because they brought such different things to the table, but were able to coalesce their styles in a way that was really exciting. And I think that, you know, to me, part of what's so exciting about Evita is that there's so much freedom for directors and choreographers in it, in the sense that the numbers don't dictate how you stage them. Like, I think you could go see, and I have seen, like, 12 productions of Evita. a little obsessed. And some numbers are staged in ways that you could never imagine them being staged, because the lines don't dictate, like, now I'm walking into the house, now I'm sitting down at the table. And I think that's part of the lack of dialogue helps with that. But, you know, I mean, and I think that, like, Halprin's production embraced that in the most amazing way that was so inspiring to us because it was so abstracted.
Right.
And, like, one of the things that we pay homage to pretty directly in our production is he staged Art of the Possible as a game of musical chairs initially. So we did our own sort of stylized version of it, but
so that's not in the text. That
no,
is a
it's not
directorial
in the text.
Choice. Always thought it was.
Not in the text.
Just even the way the music starts and stops.
Yeah.
It sounds like musical chairs, whether you know it or not.
One has no rules, is not precise. One rarely acts the same way twice. One spurns no device. Practicing the art of the possible.
I I think that the idea of it being a game of elimination has always been part of it.
It's the structure of the song.
There's nothing in the libretto that suggests that it's supposed to be that. And the revival didn't do it that way.
The last revival.
Yeah, the last revival didn't do it that way. So, we sort of felt, as we were starting out, that like we stylistically were closer to house production than we were to the revival. Mm-hmm. Not through any judgment on either, but we were just like stylistically, we live more in that world. So I think there's naturally more that we borrowed or were inspired by from that production. And Hal was very inspired by doubling and tripling. And his first conversations with Tim Rice and Andrew Lloyd Webber, he came to them and he pitched three Avas. Mm. And they said no. So obviously I didn't get to ask him about that, but I got to ask Tim about it and others. And there's some things in various folks' biographies written about his interest in tripling. Mm-hmm. And so we obviously didn't triple, but doubling, I think, in many ways, in addition to all the dramaturgical reasons that we were interested in it, was also about, you know, paying homage to that idea of his and what it means to do that.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com.
In your really excellent TED Talk, which I watched, and which everyone who's listening to this, as soon as you're done, you should go watch your TED Talk.
Thanks.
You said something that I jotted down because I thought it was just so brilliant. As a director, you said, I must investigate what it means to be telling the story in the time and in the place that I'm telling it. Mm-hmm. And that might seem obvious, but it's not always the case, right? And it's very clear to me, having seen your production of Evita, that is very much, you know, your approach to this piece. And as you're talking about your production team, I keep hearing the name of women. And it sounds to me like part of that mission was bringing a team of women together.
Absolutely.
To tell this woman's story, which has historically not been the case for this musical.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, I mean, there's never been a first-class production of Evita directed or choreographed by a woman. We're technically not a first-class production, so there's still never been one.
What class are you?
I don't know.
Well, you're first class in my mind.
Thank you. Yeah. I mean, it's like the categorization of, I guess, like Broadway and the West End class or national tours. So that blew my mind when I heard it.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess it's not surprising, but I was also just saddened by it because it just feels like I feel like I understand her story from the perspective of being a 25-year-old woman, and she's 25 at the age that she becomes first lady, 25, 26. And I think that women have something to say about her story. Not to say that anybody got it wrong. I mean, everybody got it right.
Yeah.
But I think there's like an added dimension to allowing women to tell her story, and also an added dimension to allowing Argentinians to tell her story. And we had 9 Argentinians on the team, in various capacities, and that was also so critical to me because I think, you know, if you go and talk about her in Argentina today, she is such a divisive figure. Mm. She means so much to so many people in good ways and bad ways, and I was like, I think we need to tell that story from the perspective of the people who live it every day. And so we were so lucky to do that, and you know, the example that sort of trickled its way into the piece most sort of compactly, is that our costume designer, Alejo Vietti, is from Rosario, Argentina. And his father was in the Navy when the Peruans were in power. And he went to a ceremony where he was required to shake Eva's hands. All the men in his naval unit were required to shake her hand. She went on the line and she shook all their hands. And when she got to the end of the line, they all took their gloves off and they threw them on the ground. And as a means of saying, we are not in support of you. And she threw them all in jail for a night. So when I had this conversation with Alejo about doing the show, he was like, yeah, I'll do the show, but just so you know, Eva put my dad in jail. So I don't have particularly nice feelings about her. You know, so it was about incorporating that viewpoint of someone who, for whom this story means so much. And we actually put that glove throwing into the production. Yes, yes. So, you know, it's things like
once
that.
Once again, those images. You know. Yeah. That was a very powerful moment when he takes the glove off. It was very clear. I did not know the backstory, and I'm really glad you just told us all that, because it's really powerful. It's really interesting too that you talk about going down to Argentina, and you talk about what a divisive figure she mm-hmm. still is down there. And yet I think going back to your casting a younger Eva, mm-hmm. I think that really helped, in my experience of watching the show, it helped put that all into perspective. Mm. So in other words, older Eva is somehow, with the presence of the younger Eva, softened. It makes her a sympathetic character. But then, while almost at the same time that you're having that experience, you have the Shay character who is vilifying her, or you have the army, or so it's constant, right? This idea, you're constantly reinforcing this idea of what a complicated figure she was. There was good, there was bad, and everybody had an opinion about her. And it's just so beautifully done. I don't have a question.
I wish really you wrote our reviews.
It's really more of a compliment.
It's so nice.
But
thanks.
Well, you know, it's interesting because you also mentioned Hal Prince, and because you can't talk about the show without talking about, you can't really talk about theater without talking about Hal Prince.
Correct.
But that's another podcast. But his production looms large, mm-hmm. right? And I would imagine that when you were putting this all together, you had to kind of navigate through that a little bit, right? And,
absolutely.
And reconcile with that.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, he's obviously such an inspiration to me, and so at no point did I want the sentiment of the production to ever feel like, oh, well, they got it wrong, so now we're correcting it.
Right.
Because that's genuinely not how I feel, because I think, you know, in the 70s, their telling of Evita was amazing. And
it was,
and
in
also,
the time and the place that they were telling.
Exactly.
It.
And it would be amazing again now. I think that there are like 27 different productions of Evita that could coexist, because it mm-hmm. is a musical with all those contours and colors within it. So I just, you know, I wanted to be so clear that we wanted to respect what came before us, while also saying, you know, revivals give us the opportunity to do something new. So
right. Is there talk about this being a first class production? Let's just get to it.
Sure. Yeah, right. I mean, the conversations are so complicated, mm-hmm. but that would be such
Wouldn't
a dream.
That'd be nice. Yeah,
that would
right?
be such a dream. Let's all go cross our fingers.
Well, you mentioned we could talk about Evita all day, and I know we have
other things
that we want to talk to you about. But you mentioned Che just now.
Yes.
And I didn't want to let this moment pass without talking to you about that character, because ever since I first encountered this musical as a 10-year-old listening to my double CD of the original Broadway production, I've always been so confused uh-huh. by that character, by just the decision to put Che Guevara,
right.
a Cuban revolutionary, in this story about Argentina when he wasn't, I mean, you know, his activism was... Eva was dead, right? By the time he was, you know, organizing. How did you approach that character? What was your thought process behind sort of bridging those gaps and making it your own for this production?
Yeah, it's complicated. To me, he was the biggest challenge, because I disagree with him. In terms of, I'm on Ava's side.
Yeah,
as a human, like, and poor sweet Jason Gauthier, who did a miraculous job in the role. was like, you so clearly don't agree with my character. And I was like, that's correct. and I tried so hard to hide it. I think that, you know, for me, actually, you mentioned, you know, like a future first class production. Mm-hmm. That's the thing that I want to keep cracking. Mm-hmm. Not in terms of anybody's performance, but in terms of who Che is in this version of the story, because I think that, you can choose to lean hard in the Che Guevara direction. We did not.
Right.
When you don't, I my 13-year-old cousin came to one of our run-throughs, similarly to Ginny DeSoria and Jack Fertel, gave the most amazing notes. The biggest note of which was, who's that guy? And she pointed to Jason. And I was like, it's a fair note. We didn't really tell you who he was. He just showed up and started telling the story. So I think, you know, to me, he was inspired by Che Guevara, which is essentially what Tim Rice says, but is not literally Che Guevara. But I very much admit that I think there's another frontier to how that character functions in this version of the piece. Should be so lucky as to get to do it again.
Have more time to assess it all out.
Yeah, more than 10 days, by the way, everybody. You have 10 days to make these if you don't know. 10 days.
Yeah.
It's my mission statement to make sure everybody knows. 10 days.
That's right.
Thank you.
Which is remarkable.
Yeah, it really
One,
is.
That they ask people to do that.
Yeah.
Two, that people accept that job. And that it is always pulled off. I mean, it always comes together. I mean, obviously, certain shows are more successful than others, yours being at the top of that list. But it had to have been a crazy, crazy frustrating process for you as a director.
I will say that actually the 10 days, the like notorious 10 days, themselves were not bad, because we psyched ourselves up so much about them that we planned every single minute and we knew exactly what we were going to do. And we had 10 days of pre-production before that with these amazing PACE students. So we came in and we hit the ground running. What for me was very difficult was when the show opened and suddenly there are 2,300 people watching something that you made in 10 days,
right.
And 10 days and a day and a half of tech to paint the full picture. And you just feel very naked because, you know, typically you'd have three times that or more, four times.
There's
that.
No preview period.
There's no preview period.
You just open.
Yeah. And so I would watch the show. I actually had to stop watching the show because I was like, I couldn't watch it without thinking, I want to change these 20 things.
Right.
And the actors were doing such an incredible job, but I was like, you're trapped in a show that's not done. And so that is what Encores is, and it's beautiful and it's magical. But as an artist, of course, you're like, I want to keep going,
right.
You know? So I'm really proud of what we made. And at the same time, I think there would be a lot more to do if in a world where we have more time. Yeah.
But as a director, globally speaking, do you feel that way about all your shows? Or do you ever feel like, okay, this is done. We are finished with this piece.
I kind of do. I mean, I can't help but go back and also I haven't had shows that have run for very long yet. But my point of reference is I did a show at the ART last year, and the play is short, and we had a long rehearsal period, and we got to a point where I was like, all right, we're ready.
Yeah.
And now we're doing another production of the play, and there are tons and tons of things that we're changing now based on what we learned from the audience and everything. But I felt it more way more in this process than I think in other processes, because we had so many ideas. And I think part of it was the match of this version of Evita with the City Center process, because what they do there is heroic. What the staff does is heroic. And I think oftentimes they're not reinventing these musicals. They're saying, look at this gem from 1957. we're going to show it to you in a sort of what's it called, like a museum piece of what it was. And of course directors put their stamp on it, and but it is oftentimes an homage to what it originally right. was. And for us, we were like, we are reinventing the wheel and doing it in 10 days. And I think it was the combo of those two things. If we had been recreating house production or doing something quote unquote easier,
right.
I don't think I would feel that because we'd have a product that we know works. Mm. But we were experimenting with new ideas.
Yeah. That's really interesting, because what I'm hearing you say is that because you had this 10-day process, it allowed you the liberty to take these chances that you didn't have any. You couldn't second guess yourself at all, right? So you strip something, you add this, you do that. You just have to do it and move on and make it work.
Yeah, that's the thing that it's magical for, is that you go with your first impulse and you
yeah.
run.
Yeah.
And it teaches you a lot about who you are as an artist, I think, mm. because you learn what your default is.
Yeah.
So, and you also don't have time to, I mean, I don't know, as a director, like, and I think this is probably because I'm younger, but like, I constantly analyze the way I talk to actors. Like, I constantly analyze the way that I run a room. I constantly am like self evaluating. And Encores gives you no time for that. You're just like, I'm a director, and I'm going to say things, and things are going to happen now. Yeah, things happen.
Yeah.
And you brought up, you just brought up ART, and you mm-hmm. have a history with the American Repertory
yeah.
Theater. So a couple things, you know, what are the benefits and challenges of working in a theater like that? And I think one of the productions you did was Violet, as well as In College,
yeah.
A show on a bus.
Yeah.
And staged on a bus, so I want to know that, and do you have other site-specific things in mind? And
yeah. I mean, ART is such a magical place in a way that's different from City Center, both magical places, but different. And I think, to me, what makes ART so special is its mission statement of expanding the boundaries of theater, because everything that they do is about questioning what theater is and can be. And I think that boldness and that audacity is, like, so thrilling. And I've worked on 9 shows there in the past however many years, and Violet, as you mentioned, we did on a moving bus that drove through Cambridge, and it stopped at various stops, and the audience was on the bus with mm-hmm. the actors, and it was amazing, because I think at ART they're used to asking questions like, I mean, they're not used to asking questions like, you know, when do we need to fill up the bus's gas? But they're used to asking questions like that, because so much of the work they do is so idiosyncratic that they're not shy about questions of, you know, they had a garden on stage 4 seasons ago, and, you know, now they have boats running around the stage in Moby Dick. And, you know, it's like there are all these things that are outside of the boundaries of what we typically think of as theater. So working there was really special. And then in terms of site-specific work, we're hoping that a production of Ragtime that was site-specific on Ellis Island may be on the way in full soon. We'll see what happens.
When was that done?
I directed a concert of it in 2016 mm. that was on Ellis Island, and it was for one night. It was such a special experience for me, getting to, you know, be in the middle of it all. But I think the goal of it was always to see, could we do this for a long period of time on the island, make it accessible, and tell this story that, like, really matters right now. I mean, Ragtime always matters, but, like,
yes.
right now, like,
no, especially even, right now.
It's like,
yes.
Every minute it gets more and more relevant.
Right.
And I think that we have been, you know, trying to get it off the ground, and we're close.
The skies were blue and hazy, rarely a storm, barely a chill. La, 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 la. The afternoons were lazy, everyone warm, everything still. La, 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 la. And there was distant music, simple and soft, how sublime.
And tell us, how many people were in the company when you did the concert version of Ragtime at Ellis Island?
Oh, I think it was 46.
Wow.
I love that.
I know.
That's crazy.
Did you have a full orchestra?
So we had 12 pieces.
Okay.
Yeah. And it was such a wacky venture. I mean, I look back on it now and I was like, how did wait, what? Because, you know, I had, after I did Violet on a Bus in college, I like made a list of site-specific musicals that I was, you know, musicals that could be performed site-specifically.
Yeah.
Ragtime paired with Ellis Island was at the top of that list, and we wrote to the National Park Service, and we said, hey, like, how do you do an event on Ellis Island? At the time, the plan was to do, like, some friends around a piano singing songs from Ragtime on Ellis Island just to, like, test what it would be like. And they sent us a permit that was like, you can rent Ellis Island for the night. So we did. Raised $150,000. And it snowballed into this thing that was so much bigger than we anticipated, because we... I was friendly with Laura Michelle Kelly, and she had said to me, you know, if you ever... I was like an intern on a show that she was doing, and she was so sweet to all the interns, and she said, you know, if you ever need me to like come sing anything for you, and I think she meant like at 54 Below, but like I'll do it. And so I was like, hi Laura, like, do you want to come sing Mother in Ragtime on Ellis Island? And she was like, okay. And then as soon as we had her on board, we were like, well, now we need people who are of her caliber, and it was just this amazing snowball that just grew.
And so, I think what you're talking about, I think there's a very important lesson twice in what you just said, both with calling the Parks Department and just calling Laura Michelle Kelly.
Yeah.
And that is, you have to ask for what you want. You have to just do it. Sometimes the craziest ideas that you think people will think are the craziest ideas are not to other people the craziest ideas.
Yeah.
Like, clearly the Parks Department heard that and thought, oh, well, sure, why not? For who knows what? Who knows? Maybe they wanted the money. Maybe they like Ragtime. I don't know what their motivations were for it, but that's not the point. The point is, you had the gumption to say, all right, I'm gonna call this person, I'm gonna call that person, and then suddenly all the pieces fall into place. Plus, who else? You got Laura Michelle Kelly. You just said, now we have to elevate the class. We have to surround ourselves with like talent. Who else was in that company?
Brandon Victor Dixon, Shana Taub, Brian Stokes Mitchell narrated it.
Oh my gosh.
Aisha Jackson with Sarah, Michael Park, Andy Mantis. It was like such a...
And,
we were so like,
Robert
Georgia
Petkoff.
Engel, Robert Petkoff. Yeah. I mean, it was,
and
like,
did
what?
That's we keep saying this, it's a first class A production of a show.
Yeah.
And I think it's just remarkable that you were younger than you are now and that you did it, and I think it's, I guess I just have to say this one more time, it's that class, it's a great lesson of you have to do what you believe in and you have to just try. I think that's, it's your proof right there.
Thanks.
You know, you're operating in a world in which tragically there are not a lot of female directors who are working, you know, in first-class productions of musicals.
Yeah.
And that's changing, thank heavens. And I know you worked with Rachel Chavkin on Great Comet, and she's, you know, one
Queen.
Of the women who's pioneered. But, you know, it was very striking in her Tony acceptance speech, right?
Yeah.
Where she said, you know, for an industry whose job it is to imagine, it's shocking how little we imagine what the world could be, right?
Yeah.
So who are some other women who have been mentors to you, or who you look up to, you know, in this space?
I love this question.
Yeah.
So Rachel, first and foremost, I mean, I worked for her for 4 years, and
on Great Comet or on other projects?
On Great Comet, I was her personal assistant for 3 years,
okay.
Which was amazing.
Yeah.
It was like the hardest thing ever to quit. She just is so amazing and focused on mentorship. And I think that's not always the case. And she, you know, she has this rule that I find so incredible, that with all of her ADs, she'll say to all of us, your work comes first, which is like such a generous thing to say to someone who you really need to be around all the time. Because I feel it now that I have ADs of my own. I'm like, I really want to say that to them, but I really need them. and she, like, to her, it's like fostering the voice of the next generation is more important than her, you know, whatever she needs, you know. And I think obviously within reason, but sure. It gave me the freedom to be able to do my own work alongside working for her, and I think that's really rare. And then Dime Polis I first worked for her, and I've worked for her on and off for 7 years, and her vision of what theater can be, which is the vision of the American Repertory Theater, like right. she rewrote the mission statement, but is so inspiring to me, and working for her taught me so much. I think it goes back to what you were saying about knowing to pick up the phone and call, because when I was very, very obsessed with Dime Polis in college, like very obsessed. And so working for her was a very surreal experience. I met with her assistant director at the time, who's now her very longtime associate, Mia Walker. And she was so kind and like answered like my 27 questions. And I said, what do you think is the silver bullet to Diane's success as a director? Because I just want to know how to become Dime Polis. And she said she asks for what she needs. And I was like, I will never forget that answer, because I felt, and you know, it goes back to what you were saying about being a woman and being a young woman in particular. Yeah. When I walk into rooms, particularly high caliber rooms, it's very hard to have the courage to say like, no, I'm sorry, I need you to be on time, or no, I'm sorry, I really would like that dress to be blue, or you know, to say like I need more tech time, like, and to know what you need to ask for, because at the end of the day, the product is on you, and if you don't ask for what you need, the product will suffer. And so that has stayed right here for ever. I mean, since that conversation. So those two, Diane Borger at the American Repertory Theater, has given me like every opportunity I've ever had, and is like, we went to Korea together to do research for a play. She's the most amazing warm woman, who, she's not a director, but like has opened the doors for so many directors. And she, it's so funny, she has a group of women in London, like every female director in London who's like 40 and under at some point was given a job by Diane Borger. And so she has this club of like girls that are forging a new path. And she's the executive producer at the American Repertory Theater. She is Diane Polis's counterpart. So, you know, them and so many others, but yeah. I'm lucky. Good role models.
Yes. You referenced this a little bit ago, but next up for you is Celine Song's Endlings,
yes,
which is the production at ART you spoke about a moment ago. Tell us a little bit about Endlings.
So it's a play about Korean free divers who live on islands off the coast of mainland South Korea. And there are these remarkable women, women only, who dive to harvest seafood off the ocean floor, and they do it without any equipment. So no scuba, no snorkel, nothing. They go up to 60 feet deep, and they can hold their breath, some of them, for up to 20 minutes.
Oh, my God.
And the craziest thing about them is that they never retire, so you do it until you die. And so the oldest woman doing it right now in Korea is 98 years old. And the majority of women who are still diving are in their 70s, 80s, and 90s, because fewer and fewer young women are choosing to go into the profession, and it's going extinct. So now there are only 6,000 of these women left in the world, and UNESCO predicts that in 15 years there will be none of them. So the play is about the lives of these women. Act one is about the lives of these women, and then act two is about what it means for Celine, who's the playwright, to be writing about them in the very whitewashed theatrical landscape that she's writing in. Mm. And so I love the play so much. ART was such an amazing experience to work on it. And like, you know, much like I was saying with Encores, to get more time to keep working is such a gift. And the production at New York Theatre Workshop will be a bit different in a number of specific ways, in that the space is quite different from ART. So we've redesigned the set quite a bit, but it is the same DNA of the production at ART. So,
and when does it begin?
We start previews in mid-February, and we open March 9th.
Okay.
So very, very excited.
Are you in rehearsals now, or do you start shortly?
Mid-January. Okay. Yeah, and our rehearsals are particularly fun because we rehearse 5 days a week in a rehearsal studio, and then the sixth day we go to a pool. So, because there's a tank on stage, I should say that. So we have a 40-foot long water tank that's on stage.
Wow.
And the actors who are all senior citizens dive and swim during the course of the show.
Not only is it a story that, like, my jaw dropped when you started describing it, but also, you know, it sounds like a piece that is anchored by older actors.
Yes.
Which is another, you know, talk about an underrepresented group and a group who never gets exciting new material to perform.
I mean, it's been remarkable to audition. And actually, this morning I was auditioning understudies for the three women, which is a particularly heroic track because we're hiring one understudy who's going to cover the three women star in it. So she has a hefty task. But, you know, elderly Asian women are a group that have been given terrible roles over the years. Yeah. I mean, no role is terrible, but not been given meaty roles over the years. Right. And I think that it's so frustrating to me and to Celine when we watch the reels of these women when we're trying to cast them. And everything is like, you know, all the roles that they're playing are so stereotypical in a way that is really frustrating. So I think one of the amazing things that Celine has done in writing this play is created these really meaty roles for Asian women in their 70s. And I'm in awe of her and so lucky to be working on the play. So.
Oh, great. Well, we can't wait to see it because I will be there. I love New York Theater Workshop, and you've hooked me with that.
No,
with
I'm
that
so
setup.
Glad.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love it too. Such
perfect.
A cool place.
You don't like to make it easy on yourself, do you?
No. Ellis Island, a 40-foot tank.
You're really it feels like you're clearly drawn to projects that have social significance. You're clearly drawn to projects that highlight women or have really strong female roles. You're really drawn to projects that are logistically complicated.
Yes.
Or you make the projects logistically complicated. I'm not sure which. But I think it's what probably interests you the most, the combination of these things, correct?
It's better than I could have said it myself. Yeah. It's the complexity. I mean, it's like I feel so silly to say this, but I really don't know how to direct like two people on a couch plays. Like, I respect the hell out of them and I go see them all the time, but I don't know how to do intimacy and simplicity in that way.
Right.
I mean, I know how to do intimacy, but like the where I think, and I don't necessarily know why, but I gravitate towards things that are very challenging, physically speaking, in the sense of like I can't wait to like one day work with automation, like because I'm like, I love tech, I love moving things, I love, you know, scenery. I'm doing an opera this year, and like I'm so excited about what it means to work in opera with like so many big moving pieces. And you know, my personal like dream job of like my entire life is the Olympic opening ceremonies, because it's like that level of complexity and scope and size is just so thrilling to me as a storyteller. And so all these things sort of feel related to that in some kernel way.
I love that you have a goal of the Olympic opening ceremonies. I had written a question and that question was, where do you see yourself in 10 years? And I think you may have given a version of an answer to that.
I don't
that.
Know if it's 10 years, maybe it's 20. But
or maybe five, you know. Well, maybe not five, because these things are probably planned a little
also,
bit.
Also, they're uneven years.
Oh, that's true.
Right, okay. It probably has to be in America, because they're not going to, I doubt I'd get hired.
Usually it's
like
a local hire.
Like
yeah, that's true. You know?
So a lot of things happen.
So we need to get behind an Olympic campaign for
yes.
U.S. City.
Thank
we
got
to make this happen.
But it's interesting that I think you know, as we live in as we live in complicated times, mm-hmm. that we do, I think it's really interesting that you're not interested in telling a simple, uncomplicated story, or telling a story in an uncomplicated way. Like, I think that the world in which we live and the things that you are drawn to live perfectly together. Mm-hmm. So, I'm excited. Yes. Also, that opera that you referenced, is that Carmen?
Yes.
Yes.
I'm directing it.
With Master Voices, right?
With Master Voices. Yes. In the spring. I've never directed opera before, so I'm learning very
quickly.
You
picked a good one. Yes.
I didn't pick it, but I'm so jazzed. Yeah. And it's for one night at Rose Hall at Lincoln Center, and it's like very. I'm really grateful that they trusted me with it, because. Mm-hmm. I'm so excited to move into that art form, and I feel like I needed a safe way to do it. And yeah. this, you know, obviously it's not safe. It's a Lincoln Center, but it's one night, so it's not reviewed. There, it doesn't have to be sustainable. Right. It can just be like, what can we do in one
and
night?
And that's a very unique space, Rose Hall.
Yeah.
So that's another, you know, sort of challenge built into it. How do you do an opera with a stage like that?
Well, we're lucky because Carmen has all these allusions to bull rings, and you know, many directors have staged it in as if we're in a bull ring, but that theater is shaped like a bull ring,
right.
So we are very lucky and we fit right into that. So.
You went to Argentina to research and prepare for Evita. You're new to the opera world. What's that research process going to be like?
Seeing a lot of opera, because I mean, it's two levels for me, right? It's researching the form, and then researching the content. So I'm starting with form, and calling a lot of directors who've done opera and just saying, "What's your process?" Reading books. I'm just starting now, so it's fun, and I'm going to see a lot of opera in the next.
Did you see Akhenaten?
No.
Oh, we
I
loved
know
it.
You
we
told me
it.
To.
We loved it. Well, I think it was Des McAnuff in our interview who said one of the things he loves about directing, maybe this what didn't make the final cut or not, but is that you get to dive into a whole world and you get to learn everything you can about this one very specific subject, right?
It did make the final cut.
There you
I listened
go. Okay.
To the
yes,
episode.
Yes.
Yes. Yes. I mean, it's just, and I think like I've now done this for three shows where I've taken like very. Immersed trips to try to and I don't personally like going on vacation. it's not something that I get joy out of, and like my mother is kind of the same way, so like what we do instead is we go on like research trips. It's very nerdy. And so that was Argentina, and then that was Korea when I went with Diane Borger, and I find that like if I can bring into the room an experience of having lived the story firsthand in some specific way, mm-hmm. I am so much better at my job than if I hadn't done that. And obviously it's expensive and everything, but when you're not, you know, going to Florida or the Bahamas, you can go to Korea. I find it so enriching. And I think like as a director, I'm like so research oriented and historical musicals are sort of, in addition to what you said, like I gravitate so heavily to them because there's so much I can do and learn before I even step foot in the room.
So is a trip to Spain on the horizon?
So I've been.
Okay.
So I feel like that trickles in.
You've got the setting.
You unknowingly did your research.
Exactly, right? It's the universe telling you someday
yes,
you're going to do
Carmen.
Someday,
this is going to be useful.
Right? Yeah.
So,
amazing.
Is there a historical musical that you are interested in tackling?
Many. I think Man of La Mancha is like the top of my list of things I would love to do. Aida, obviously there's a production in the works now, mm-hmm. so not anytime in the near future, but maybe in another state or like elsewhere. I'd really love to revisit Violet now that like I'm a little older and like have more research under my belt. Those are like the three historical ones that are Les Mis. I mean, but when do you get to direct a production of Les Mis?
Well, we have one final question that we ask everyone. I think you're probably aware of what this question is.
Yes. I've been thinking about it.
I'm not surprised. But that is, what was that show or experience that made you want to do what you do?
So my answer is pre-prepared because I'm a very avid listener. So when I was a freshman in college, I saw Diane Paulus' revival of Pippin. And I was lucky in that, like, I grew up around a lot of theater. I saw a ton of theater. But seeing that production was the moment where I was like, ah, I'm doing this. Because I sat and watched Act One, knowing the musical, but then also knowing what Diane did to it. And then at the end of Act One, I, like, turned around in my seat, and I was sitting, like, towards the back of the orchestra, and Diane Paulus was standing behind me, like, noting her own show. And it was just, like, something clicked with having seen that and then seeing the human who dreamt it up. And I was like, oh, I could do that. And so that was when I was like, I want to be a director. And then I went up to her, and I was like, hi. I'm a fangirl. And then I worked for her for 7 years.
Exactly.
So
that's next level.
Exactly. Yeah. But,
so had you not thought about being a director before that moment?
I had, very much so. But I was on a, like, my mom works in theater and my dad works in film. And when I done a ton of theater as a kid, had some, like, bizarre, quote-unquote, directing experiences as a kid, as much as it could be called directing, and then was in a period of revolt when I went to college because I was like, I'm not going to do what my mom does. I don't want to, you know, be that kid who, like, you know, goes into the family business. And then that the moment of seeing Diane was the moment that I was like, I'm coming out of my period of revolt. Here we go.
Well, the world is a better place that you went into the family business. Yes. I can say that.
Yeah.
Also, did we talk about this? Pippin was my show.
Really?
Yeah,
oh,
but
that's
the
right.
But the original production.
Wow.
My parents, for better or worse, took me when I was way too young to see the show. I was
that's the only way to see Pippin, when you're way too young, as far as I'm concerned.
I was like 9. Or so I was really young.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, you know the show.
Obviously.
But it was the show for me that I thought, what is this?
Right.
What is this? What is happening? Who are these people?
Interesting.
What is this thing?
You should do a tally of everybody's responses and see what the most popular.
We have a lot of Fiddler on.
Fiddler.
The
a lot of
yeah.
Fiddler.
Yeah. A lot of Fiddler. Yeah. There's one other. Fiddler and I think you're the first Pippin outside of me, right?
Wow.
Yeah. I'm Hello Dolly. That
He's
was
Hello
show.
Dolly.
Okay.
There's
right.
a few Hello Dolly.
I
remember
local high school production. Yeah, and that hooked me. Yeah.
I was Fiddler because I was 4 or 5, I think.
Oh,
four.
My gosh.
And I saw, that was the first production I saw.
Yeah.
So
in Manchester, right?
In Manchester, New Hampshire.
Wow.
Yeah. So that's what
Amazing.
Did it, you know?
Oh. Wow.
I remember, they know this, but I was looking at a little girl on stage, the youngest daughter, and I was in the front row balcony, and I was tugging on my mother's coat. I was like, I don't want to be up here. I want to be down there. Well, it worked. She looks like me.
So we're glad you saw
that.
You
can't, you can't be what you can't see, right?
Yeah. And always like Janine Tesori's Tony speech. You have to see it to be it.
Yep. Yep. And it's
Rachel Chavkin, Diane Paulus.
You didn't
Thank
just
you.
See any director. You saw Diane Paulus.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And that's meaningful.
And
right?
I think it means a lot that, like, I look like her.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I was like, I could see myself. And,
right.
You know, I'd see myself.
Literally
and,
see yourself. You know?
Yeah, like, yeah. Like, I saw, you know, my mom my whole life. But
right.
But. When
She's
it's your mom, you're like,
right,
oh,
exactly.
My mom.
Right.
No offense, mom. She's definitely going to listen.
This is the book we need. We need the book of female Tony Award acceptance speeches of empowerment.
Yes.
But we need more women to win Tony Awards
right.
before we can have this book written.
So it's not a pamphlet, right? It
right.
needs to be,
it needs to be a
coffee table book.
Yes.
Yeah. It's got to be substantial.
Yeah. But I mean, I'm so grateful for them, for Lear de Bessene, for Annie Kaufman, for Lee Silverman, like all of them. I mean, it's so inspiring.
Lear, who's taking over
Encores.
Yeah.
And has been a huge help to me and so many others. She's such a good mentor.
Yeah.
Well, you've been very fortunate with your mentorship.
I really have.
And I assume you're gonna be
forward.
That person for somebody else.
I hope I'll be helpful.
Yeah, I think you will.
I mean, I certainly will intend to be. I don't know if what I say will be helpful. We'll find out.
Amazing.
Well, Sabby, it's been an absolute delight having you
Likewise.
Join us.
Thanks. I'm so honored as a listener. It's like, wow.
Thank
We're
you so
honored.
Much.
Thank you.
Real pleasure.
Thanks. We got magic to do.
Jamie here, that's our show. Thanks for listening.
If you like what you hear, please rate and review us on iTunes. You can find us online at thefabulousinvalid.com and on social media at fabulousinvalid and on iTunes, Spotify, and wherever you find your podcasts. The Fabulous Invalid is a production of O&M Etc. and The Fabulous Invalid, LLC, and a proud member of the Broadway Podcast Network. Our theme music is by Lucky Chops. Today's episode was edited and engineered by Aaron Kaufman, and be sure to tune in next Wednesday.
The Outsiders, S.E. Hinton's generation-defining novel, is now a powerful and moving Broadway hit that the New York Post is calling the best new musical of the season so far. Don't miss your chance to join Ponyboy and the Greasers and experience the classic story come to life in a whole new way. The New York Times calls it refreshing, gritty, and endlessly effective. So get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com, and of course, stay gold. They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com.